This week on RSVMB Update, a special episode where we discuss our passion for science and technology. We start close to home and work our way through the cosmos. Then a discussion on some important computer science issues and the future of green energy and electric cars. This is RSVMB Update, episode 705, From the Miniature to the Cosmos. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first RSVMB update of 2019. And, you know, as normally goes with things RuneScape, there is no RuneScape update on the first week of the year. And as such, we're taking this opportunity to record a bit of a special that we've wanted to do for some time. You could say we're effectively stepping into a strange new world of RSVMB update this week. And joining me for that is Sirion. Welcome.
Hey, nice to be back.
And this episode is what we're effectively calling the Science and Technology Special. And it's, you know, the strange new world side of it. And these are things that we're both very passionate about, and we could go on for, well, what, hours probably?
Days.
And so basically what we're going to do with this is we're going to give a bit of a brief rundown of why we like these topics, and then we're going to wrap it all up at the end with something that ties everything all together in that. And, you know, the topics we want to talk about with this are space, computer science, and the future of energy and green initiatives on the world when it comes to technology as well. And, you know, you might see space, and you see that as a recurring theme. We've done space tech news before. We've done computer science tech news before. One of the big ones that has been hovering around RSVMB update this year has been Meltdown and Spectre, the bugs in the Intel chips. We're going to talk about that a bit. And we're going to go into some other little computer science topics. So I don't think we can call them little, can we?
No, some of these are very, very big in computer science right now. It's an ever-changing field, but yeah, we're definitely going to talk about the trends that are currently going on.
And each one of these stories and each one of these things in here that we're going to be talking about are things that we're deeply passionate about, and things that we feel are going to be impacting the world in one way or have impacted the world. And, you know, this brings us into why we're doing this episode, is that we really think that science is one of the things in this world that people either understand it and want to be a part of it and care about it, or they just brush it aside. And this led to a question that we wanted to answer, and I think we can answer, is why is science worth caring about? So let's go.
Mm-hmm. You want me to answer now?
Yeah,
can't answer now. We have like an hour to fill with why we care.
Okay. So we want to answer that while we do the show. And what ends up happening with this is that hopefully throughout the entirety of this episode, you guys will learn a bit about why we think that. And hopefully it'll be thought-provoking enough that you guys will be able to learn that as well for yourself. I personally have a bit of a hunch as to why I feel that way. And I'll say that without science, the advancement of the last 100 and 150 years would look entirely different than it does today. And the technology that we use to communicate, and the technology even for this podcast, is all inherently based in scientific advancements in the last 50 years or so. And without any of that, without any of the scientific progress on that, we wouldn't be here. So that's what I think going into it. Now, the next thing is that you might hear the topic science. And for people who aren't necessarily interested in this on the surface, you know, your science experience might be limited to what you learned in high school, or if you took a science degree in university, what you took there. And if that's the case, and you took it even one step further and you did something along the lines of a PhD, well, then you have a very good idea of what science is. But for the rest of everybody out there, science is not the science textbook you find in your high school class, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, it took me years to figure this out. Like, it took a really enthusiastic, motivated mathematics teacher to even realize that math is actually like a really fun and interesting and beautiful thing. While before that, it was textbooks exercises for me. So, you know, I think you need to go a step further to admire what is really under the hood of all these things and how that can help us. And that's why I want to be on this show. That's why we've wanted to do this episode, to sort of show people this. It's not just formulas on paper.
And no spoilers with this, but some of these things that we talk about are literally going to be universe defining and defining the future here. So we're going to get going, and basically everything you're going to see from this point on is something related to a subject that either Sirion or myself is deeply passionate about. And you could already hear that in this episode. And you guys have heard this on Tech News episodes before, where we've gone through one of these subjects, whether it be a space subject, a math subject, or even a computer science-based subject. These are things that we love talking about, and we are just very pleased to be able to take the opportunity to share them with you, the listeners of this podcast. And we're going to begin with space. And, you know, I've talked many times before on the podcast about Star Trek and whatnot. Sure, that's a TV show, but, you know, everything there is rooted in some kind of thing up in the sky. And we're going to start with this really close to home. And this summer there was a lunar eclipse, and this one was only visible across Europe, if I remember correctly.
I believe so, yeah.
So I didn't get to see this, but I think you did, right?
I'm afraid I live in a city where a bright sky is very, very rare. So
oh.
I'm afraid I didn't see it myself. It was cloudy that day. Of course, in London, we have lots of light pollution as well. So these effects are generally not as visible as you want. I have heard of stories from the Netherlands, though, where people have seen it. They generally thought it was a bit disappointing. I mean, the moon isn't that big in the sky, right?
No.
So it's definitely not as impressive as a solar eclipse, because it just doesn't have that much impact. But people still, yeah, it is very much an I was there feeling, I think, that we can all sort of, I think it's a good moment to reflect of how cool these things are.
Yeah, and
basically emergent.
It's a feature of our Moon-Earth system that you don't normally think about, because you just see the moon up in the sky, and you know, from time to time the moon will be extra bright and you'll have a clear night to see it. And basically what happens with a lunar eclipse is you have the sun in the center of the solar system, and a lunar eclipse happens when the Earth's shadow is cast up upon the moon, and it happens in a period of a full moon, or at least a partial moon, where that can be then reflected back down to observers on the planet. Now, that's different from a solar eclipse, whereas a solar eclipse, the moon blocks out a portion of the sun, dimming the brightness of it. And I think that's why people see the solar eclipse as the more spectacular one. But the lunar eclipse can be equally as spectacular, and perhaps even I've heard people describe it as creepy, because it's red. And if you happen to catch it just at moonrise, you'll notice that it appears bigger in the sky. And this is something that I forget what the exact name of the effect is, but the moon is the same size in the sky, whether it's closer to the horizon or up above in the sky. The only difference is your perspective as a human, because as humans, our vision has evolved to a sense where things that are closer to the horizon, our brain perceives to be larger. And that's why if the moon is closer to the horizon, it'll seem to be bigger. And that's why some of the best lunar eclipses to watch are ones that appear near moonrise or moonset, because they'll appear bigger in the sky. Unfortunately, I think this one in the summer was during the middle, when the moon was up high in the sky. But it's certainly something to witness. I've witnessed a number of lunar eclipses here in North America in the past, and they are something, even if you've seen them before. And, you know, I think that's something that people don't necessarily appreciate until they've seen one, is that you think you've seen one lunar eclipse, but if you keep going out and you see it, it's still amazing every time.
Mm. And people might like wonder as well, like, why doesn't this happen all the time? Like the sun, like doesn't the Earth stand between the sun and the moon, like every time the moon goes around? But another thing you have to realize is that while often the solar system is shown flat, it's the, like it's not quite flat. It's 3D, right? The orbits are slightly angled towards each other, so everything needs to line up just perfectly for the lunar eclipse to actually happen. And you know, we all learn sort of how the Earth goes around the Sun and the Moon goes around the Earth in school, but for me, like actually playing with it, like for example, I played a lot of Kerbal Space Program. Like that made me really realize how difficult and unintuitive orbital mechanics are. And you know, that is something that is so cool about this day and age, that you know, there's so much material on YouTube. There are games that explore these concepts. It has never been easier to get into science and follow up on the topics you find interesting. And you know, I think I've enjoyed learning things through YouTube and those channels more than I've done in school. So I had a great university time, like doing things at your own pace and following up on topics you find interesting. Like that's a unique opportunity that we didn't have before.
Yeah. Another one to add on to the list with Kerbal Space Program is Universe Sandbox.
That's a great one to play around with as well.
Yeah, I've actually crashed my computer before because of the amount of stress I've tried to put on things. But that's a topic for another day. So we talked about the lunar eclipse, and you know, I think when it comes down to it, the lunar eclipse is probably the closest we're going to get to Earth in this space and science segment. Next one is something that I just shook my head about when I saw the mainstream media reporting this, and I'm not entirely sure how this is end up supposed to be pronounced, but I'm going to guess Oumuamua. Okay.
Oumuamua, yeah.
And this was an asteroid that was very bizarrely shaped, and it came from outside the solar system. And this led reporters in the mainstream media and some other outlets online to suggest that it was an alien spacecraft.
It's like, to be honest, this the fault was partly with the researchers from, what was it, Harvard, I think?
Yeah.
The way they explained things in the media was maybe a bit too suggestive in that direction. It was one of the options that, like, because it had to do with how the rotation of the object was not entirely how we would expect from normal physics. And one of the explanations was that some alien green guy inside was controlling how the thing was moving. However, there were also other explanations,
which NASA JPL chimed in with, and they basically said, you know, this is an asteroid that did indeed come from the outside of the solar system, and we can pretty much explain everything that has been happening with its speed and rotation. Basically, what happens with this asteroid is they said that in the research paper that talked about this and all the links and whatnot pertaining to everything we're talking about will be coming in our show notes at update.rsbnb.com. They basically concluded that the expelled gas from the asteroid was acting like a thruster that was giving it its odd rotation mechanics, which is what people thought, hey, this might be one small, very small percent chance that it could be an alien spacecraft, the fact that it was acting like a thruster, but it was really outgassing from the asteroid itself. So
it is still mind-boggling, though. Like, I don't think we realize how empty space is, right? I don't know the exact scale, but I remember that the scale you have to think about is like put like a tiny marble on like a soccer field, and that's like the percentage of space that's actually filled within a solar system.
Yep.
And then between solar systems, it's even emptier. Like, space is so empty, you just cannot imagine it. And then an object spent millennia traveling between solar systems. Millennia, millions of years probably, just not encountering anything. It just passed the sun in like a few months, and now it's going to not encounter anything anymore for another million years. Like, the scale at which we're talking here is immense and humbling in a way.
Yeah.
And either we were extremely lucky to find an object, or maybe space is not as empty as we thought it to be. That's something we'll have to research over the next few years. But this occurrence was quite unique. And, you know, when we talk astrophysics, like we talk really, really low probabilities on encountering things. So it was a surprise to anyone, I think, that it happened.
Yeah, and just for perspective, how fast this thing came in and left, on July 29th, 2017, it was outside the orbit of Mars. Fast forward to September 2nd, 2017, it was inside the orbit of Mercury. And then 1 month later, it had passed the orbit of Venus. And 3 weeks later, it was out again past the orbit of Mars, leaving the solar system.
That is fast.
We need to underscore here just the massive scale that we're talking about. For something to be come in the orbit of Mars and then leave the orbit of Mars within 3 months, that's a pretty fast object, all things considered. When if you look at the spacecrafts we send to Mars, those take on average anywhere between 6 and 8 months to get there. So you can see effectively double the amount of speed is what this thing had. So it's been going for a long time, and it's just going to keep going. And it was at something called perihelion, which means that it was its closest point to our sun on September 9th, 2017. And then I don't want to think what that object's aphelion is going to be. It's the furthest point away.
There is no aphelion.
Okay,
because it's not gonna wind itself back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. And see, this is another math concept. Something in regards to a hyperbolic path is something you hear in math, and here we are describing this to describe this orbital or not orbital path, just this path of
and
this
again,
thing going
like,
through the solar system.
Like all this terminology, like Kerbal Space Program, just playing it. Like I've learned. Well, the problem is to play Kerbal Space Program and to be able to do it, you probably have to look up these concepts and how to do it and learn a lot about like space launches and orbits and transfer trajectories between planets and all that stuff. You learn so much and you think you're just doing it to play a game, but at the end of it, you're pretty adept, I think, at the orbital mechanics. So if you're looking at a job at a space agency, start playing today.
You know, I don't think we've ever done Kerbal Space Program as pick of the week.
It's going to be the implicit pick of this week.
Yeah, it's going to have to be. And it's actually on we're recording this for before Christmas now. And the Steam Winter Sale, of course, is happening. And the Kerbal Space Program is 60% off right now. But obviously, you guys will be hearing this after, so unfortunately, that window will have passed. But I'll have to add that to the picks of the week list for going into next year. Surprising, we didn't get that ever. So
sounds good.
All right. So next up, we talked a bit about Mars and the orbit of Mars in this rogue asteroids, or is it? It's an asteroid, or is it a comet? I don't think we.
I believe it's an asteroid.
Yeah, it looks like an asteroid from the way it was going. Because if it was a comet, we would have been able to detect it a lot sooner from the trail and whatnot.
Yep.
So it's an asteroid. And, you know, there's many different terms in here that we've used, asteroid and whatnot versus comet. And those are two very different things in itself. A comet is one that is emitting gases. And, of course, when it is illuminated by a sun or a sun causes it to melt some more, that's where you get the trail from it. And comets are made up of primarily ice and rock, and hence why you get that outgassing in the trail from it. Whereas this is just an asteroid, which is a rock floating through space for all intents and purposes. And we're going to try and be as precise as we can here on this podcast, though we might mix up a few of the terms throughout. So next up, we're heading to Mars. And, you know, people don't necessarily think of Mars as being that interesting. But a couple weeks back, in fact, 24 days ago, we had the landing of the InSight probe on Mars. And, you know, you might not think this is a big deal, but how many Mars missions, what's the percentage of Mars missions that fail before they get to the surface?
More than 50%.
Right.
Fails in the landing. Not even talking about like launches being failed. No, just in the landing phase, more than 50% of the landings failed.
So the very fact that this probe was able to get to Mars, land successfully, activate its instruments, and send pictures home is a success when it comes to Mars missions in general. And, you know, people might not appreciate Mars, I don't think, but Mars is a subject that is very exciting to me because it is, of course, our closest planet, and it is probably the planet that is most like the Earth in the solar system.
No, that would be Venus.
Well, I mean, sure, but we haven't even figured out how to send probes to Venus without having them...
We have had some probes to Venus, but yeah, it's a very inhospitable environment.
Yeah, hence why Mars is the testbed and science laboratory for all of these missions. So I know you followed InSight a bit. So what exactly does InSight do differently than past Mars missions?
So InSight, it's going to do a few things. It's going to be too hard to remember all of these. One of the things it's going to do is it has a seismometer on it, which allows it to detect earthquakes and stuff. And they basically want to find out if Mars has plate tectonics, such as Earth has. So these are the continental plates that drift over the molten core. We are actually not sure if Mars has a solid core or a molten core. So that's what the seismometer is. We have sent some of these sensors before, but they're usually attached to the rovers we send, which means that all the movements on the rover get picked off. So this one is actually separate. They put it on the ground separately and detached so that it's more accurate. And what they're also going to do is they're going to also drill like a hole down in Mars to find if the temperature rises as you drill deeper. And
that, of course, would be indicative of a molten core.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were theories out there that Mars wouldn't have a molten core, and we need to verify that because Mars, of course, has no magnetic field, or at least not as nearly as strong of a magnetic field. It might have a very minute one, but
yeah,
it's measurable, but it's not enough to, if you were to put people down there, protect them from the cosmic rays coming in. And that's the whole purpose of a magnetic field. You know, we take our magnetic field here on Earth for granted. We use it for navigating to the North Pole with compasses and the like. But the main job of the magnetic field is to disperse and basically shift away all of the cosmic rays that are coming in from our sun, and that basically allows life to exist on our planet. And Mars doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to talk about this mission because, you know, they give these missions a lifespan of, I think, how long was this one? Was this one 90 days or how long was this one supposed to be?
I'm afraid I don't remember.
Okay. Well, basically what happens when a mission to Mars is set up is that the mission has a specific lifespan and how long it's supposed to last for. But what ends up happening most times with these Mars missions is that they go much longer than anticipated because the hardware was just designed so well. And, you know, there's still one of the Martian rovers out there roving around. Curiosity that was sent in, I believe that was... Gosh, what year was that?
Long ago.
Yeah, I want to say 04. Let me just check that. Check the curiosity of this.
Curiosity 2011. Was launched in 2011.
Okay. Oh, I'm thinking of Spirit and Opportunity. All right.
Yeah. 2003 for Opportunity.
Right. And both of these past Mars missions, Spirit, Opportunity, and then Curiosity lasted for much longer than they had intended to run for. And that's just in general the way these Mars missions have been going as of late. And if they accomplish their primary mission, that's considered a success. But at the end of the day, any detail that can be learned from this is going to provide lots of new information for scientists back here on Earth to discover and run through. InSight's mission duration is scheduled for 728 Earth days or 709 Mars days. So about 2 years It's supposed to be for its actual mission. So you can anticipate that this one will run much longer than that. And, you know, you don't normally think of geology as being something groundbreaking. Whoa. Did I just say that? That was not intended. Anyways, you know, you look here on Earth, you look at rocks, and you might find that boring, but it's an entirely new game when you head on over to a different planet and start looking at those rocks, or even rocks from within the solar system. So this mission, you know, you might think is boring on the surface of it, but it is going to provide countless of opportunities to be amazed. What?
Another one.
What did I do?
On the surface.
Oh. That was not intended, I swear.
What are you doing? Starting off the new year.
I'm taking your job.
You're taking my job. I'm out of a job. 2019, Siren is out of a job. How sad.
Of course, in case you're wondering what that's referring to, Sirion is the master of puns at Clan Quest. So, alrighty. I think you wanted to. You had one more sub bullet point you wanted to talk about regarding InSight in regards to colonization.
Just into Mars in general. I mean, like there are people out there that I will not name. Who believe that we should move to be an interplanetary species. And, you know, it is not unlikely. And I think we are at the time where we can, within a lifetime, see a personal presence on another... persistent presence on another planet. And that is quite exciting to me, and you know, we'll talk about our world in like in a while, but yeah, I definitely think we can learn a lot about living away from Earth, but also bring back the knowledge to maybe how we can improve this planet. So
yeah,
you know, it's a barren desert planet, but it might be hiding so much, and it makes me wonder. There's so many planets out there. Like, what do they have to hide?
Yeah, and, you know, it all started so small. You know, you have basic innovations and inventions like Velcro tabs that were pioneered in the space program going to the moon. And, you know, people always say space costs so much and space is too expensive. And, you know, that's starting to change, and we're seeing more private investment in space. And I honestly think that to move technology here on Earth forward at a faster pace, there needs to be a reason to have this constant drive forward to push ourselves and develop better technology. And we saw that with the space program going.
Yeah, we had this in the Cold War, right?
The Cold War, too. But it seems as though in recent years, following the die down of the Cold War and the, you know, lack of interest of space outside of our, you know, low Earth orbit, let's just say where the International Space Station arises, is that there really hasn't been too much in the terms of major technological breakthroughs. And I think that we need to push that boundary once again. And hopefully we're on that path to doing it with new initiatives from NASA and, of course, the private sector. So
hey, Shane, if you want to know more about this, you should read my Informer article called Space Race 2.0.
At informer.rsbnb.com. I actually forgot about that one. That was a pretty good article this past year.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned planets, and you know, I think it's fair to say that planets are something that, you know, if you go back to the 1990s, people still had no idea if there are planets outside of our solar system. It wasn't until, I believe, 1996 that they found the first gas giant, which is, of course, a big planet orbiting a pulsar, and they were able to confirm that it existed. For a while, there was only a handful of confirmed exoplanets, which are, for lack of a better term, planets that exist outside of our solar system. And as of today, recording this, there are 3,869 confirmed exoplanets. Meanwhile, there are 2,898 that are candidates to be exoplanets. And with this, NASA estimates that there are a roughly similar number, 2,886 planetary systems that have been observed. So we used to think, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago that we were our own solar system and we didn't know if there were other planets out there. But now we know that there are thousands and thousands of other planets out there. And this is where we start moving farther and farther away, because our current technology doesn't let us get to any of these exoplanets, because even at our top speeds, they would take hundreds of years to get there, if not more. And of course, the closest ones that we have found, there's one orbiting Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star away, about 4.6 light years. There's an exoplanet in that system. There was also another one found just recently, earlier this year, in 2018, what they're calling a cold super Earth, that was found about 6 light years away in a nearby star called Barnard's Star. And this one is interesting, of course, because Proxima Centauri and Alpha Centauri, as you might have heard it called before, is actually a dual star system, whereas Barnard's Star is the closest single star to our planet at 6 light years away. And they think they found a rocky type planet there. They don't know what its composition is or what its atmosphere would be like or its exact temperatures, but there are probes and telescopes being designed that will be able to survey the atmospheres and compositions of exoplanets. And one of these is the James Webb Space Telescope that's scheduled to launch in 2022, I believe. So
it has been delayed several times, so yeah, take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, take it with a grain of salt. And, you know, we need a new high-resolution space telescope like this, because Hubble is on its last legs. One of its mirrors is broken, and it's not—
I think it has officially been end of life.
Oh, that's unfortunate. So we really do need another deep observation post like that. And James Webb will be the one to do it. And the optimist in me says that something like the James Webb telescope, or James Webb itself, will be the first observatory to confirm that a planet is rocky and habitable and probably has a atmosphere that is similar to that of Earth at some point in the future. But even with that, finding such a planet is going to be very hard. And I think it's safe to say that we're within the 20-year window where we're going to be able to make that determination, probably.
Probably.
And the reason this is so big, for those of you guys who are not necessarily always interested in science and space, is that if you can find a planet that is rocky in the habitable zone as we know it, shares a similar composition to Earth, both in terms of its geology and its atmosphere, that means that it probably looks like Earth. There is a good chance of there being water on that planet. And as we all know, where there's water, there is most often life. So that's why finding such a planet is so important. And, you know, there's 2,800, or rather over 3,000 of these exoplanets that have been confirmed. One of them has to be like that, right?
That would be very likely, yes.
Yeah. And people, for the longest time, didn't think that was possible. And as soon as we're able to confirm that, the entire game for exploring deep space with these telescopes changes. And it gives us an opportunity of somewhere else to focus our telescopes and focus our research efforts from the sky. Because if you think of deep space telescopes like Hubble, they have been able to look back far enough in space to see the beginnings of the universe, almost 13 billion years. And if you can do that you can modify the technology and such that at some point we will be able to figure out what's happening on these exoplanets and learn that maybe they are indeed habitable. And that's a pretty big deal because for the longest time we didn't think that was possible. So exoplanets are perhaps one of the things in regards to space and science that I find the most interesting, because it's like the fact that you look at this and you're saying, okay, this is one Earth. There could potentially be another one there. What's on there? What does it look like? Will someone's imagination ever be able to draw a picture of that? And that's something I've always thought of too, is what would one of these far planets look like? I don't know if you've ever had thoughts like that.
I have, and, you know, there are really cool initiatives such as like light sails. You might have heard of that. They're basically like little craft that we shoot a laser at to accelerate them. It's complicated, it works, and that might be able to get to one of these solar systems within a few years. Of course, then we have to wait a few years for the signal to come back. But, you know, if we're patient, like maybe one day we'll be able to see what these planets look like.
Or we could just start broadcasting all our past television shows to these planets.
Who knows?
And this is also something else we should discuss, that when it comes down to the speed of light, we see the speed of light as being a constant object, or constant speed, rather. But if you are trying to talk to one of these planets or send a radio signal to talk to your craft that is going to one of these planets, if that planet in, let's just say, Barnard Star, which is 6 light years away, that means that your signal you send from Earth would take 6 years to get from Earth to Barnard Star, and another 6 years to get back with the response. So you're waiting 12 years just to hear back if your message you send got there and what the response was. So. And when you think about it, that's absolutely absurd that we could be waiting that long, right?
Yeah.
And I want to actually go back to InSight for just a moment, because when InSight landed, the delay between Earth and Mars is about 11 minutes, so making a round trip of about 22 minutes. They didn't know for that period of time if the mission was successful, so they were sitting on pins and needles waiting to hear back for 11 minutes.
I mean, that is
minutes.
Part of why it's so hard to land on Mars. How it has to be automated. Like, the delay is so big, you can't, like, once it's in the atmosphere, like, it's, you have no control over it.
Indeed. Anything else on exoplanets?
No.
All right. Now, this next one is a headbender and goes to the very nature of the universe itself. This was Stephen Hawking's last paper that he published before he passed away this spring, entitled A Smooth Exit from External Inflation. And yes, we have the paper here if anyone wants to read it. Though you will probably need a degree in theoretical physics to make sense from it.
Yeah.
I'll just read a bit from the abstract here. The usual theory of inflation breaks down in eternal inflation. We derive a dual description of eternal inflation in terms of a deformed Euclidean CFT located at the threshold of eternal inflation. The partition gives the amplitude of different geometries of the threshold surface in the no boundary state.
I understand some of those words.
I understand some of the words, but as to what exactly this is about, I don't know.
Not a clue.
Not a clue. And we're saying this as people who focus on this kind of content from time to time, and space and whatnot. But in general, we go down to other sources that talk about this. And do you want to take us through the brief rundown on what this was from the easy-to-read human perspective?
I'm not even sure if I can do that. But basically, inflation is the thing that happened just after the Big Bang, where space expanded in size faster than the speed of light, and you're like, hey, that's not possible. The speed of light is, you can't go faster than the speed of light. The problem is, this applies to objects. It doesn't apply to space itself. So basically, space doubled in size and doubled in size and doubled in size. And this paper talks about that phenomenon and how within that space, bubbles of universe might have started come to be. And we will be in one of these bubbles. And the space might still be just expanding between universes, explaining how we have multiple bubbles, which are multiple universes, hence the multiverse.
We should explain like what the multiverse is.
So the multiverse is the concept that we are not the only universe. There might be other universes that have different rules of physics, laws of physics, and might therefore behave completely differently or be unstable or whatever. And the reason why we are asking these questions is because the laws of physics seem so finely tuned that everything works. Like if you would change the value of the speed of light slightly, like everything would collapse, right? Somehow everything is tuned together and we don't know how that is or why that is. And you know, this paper is one step towards, like, if this paper is right, we could study the really early universe and we could start understanding a lot of things, including why is it that everything works. We would be able to understand how laws of physics were created. Now, that is a concept that I can't quite grasp. Like, that borders the divine.
I was just about to say that is almost godlike.
At that point, we would find the man behind the curtain, basically. And, you know, that is, for a lot of people, the ultimate goal. And this paper is a step towards that. And that is super exciting. And the possibility that we might find these answers, to me, is super exciting as well. So, you know, while I don't understand a word of this paper, I understand the importance and I can appreciate it for just that.
Yeah. And, you know, we look at things. You mentioned the speed of light. There's also gravity, you know, gravitational.
Gravity, Pascal length, or there is like some values in like the strong nuclear force, how strong that is, the weight of an atom or an electron, I should say.
Planck lengths.
Yeah.
There are just these various little constants in the universe that are the same everywhere you go.
Yes.
And no one understands why. There has been talk before of, you know, there was two schools of thought. You know, there was general relativity posited by Einstein and whatnot. But also at the same time, there's this new world of quantum mechanics and quantum physics that deals with the very, very tiny scales that we're talking about, you know, half of an atom, smaller than that, where things that are just bizarrely weird happen. Like electrons can have two different states at the same time, whereas we see them as one state. And that's a perfect example, Schrodinger's cat. I'll let you explain that to the listeners in case they've never heard that term before.
So when you put a cat in a box together with some poison, as long as you don't look in the box, the cat is both dead and alive. When you open the box, the cat is in one of the two states.
Yep.
We explain the cat as being in a superposition of both being alive and dead, because we don't know which one it is.
Yeah, and, you know, there's just really weird things, you know. Things that are in the state of superposition, as you called them, and that's the official term for them, we don't know what their exact state is going to be until they're observed. It might be a different state when you look at it one time, or it might be a different state the other time. That's just how weird quantum mechanics is, and why there is this push to unify the world in physics of the really small and the really large to try and come up with one equation or one theory that describes everything. And this paper from Stephen Hawking is pushing down that path. And, you know, lots of people think about these things too. I'm gonna take this actually into the realm of science fiction here for one moment. you talked about universal constants like the speed of light. There is actually a very good theory. Now, this is, of course, science fiction theory pertaining to the Star Trek universe, that the Mirror Universe, another universe in the Star Trek series, came about because of a difference in the speed of light. And it would just have so many different effects that things could be bizarro. And that's what we want to try and figure out, is that could one of these different universes exist? And what would the laws of physics be there? How would they be different than here? And is there anything that ties these two together that we can use to further understand the universe around us? And, you know, I think we're pretty far away from this because this is theoretical physics. We don't have the technology to prove this theory yet. I think we're looking at 2032, if I recall, for the probe that could look at the gravitational waves that would need to be examined for this Stephen Hawking theory.
Mm-hmm.
So that one is a while away. And as with anything science, it can be contested. It can be torn apart by other scientists. And, you know, in a few years, this theory and this paper might look like something that was really silly. But we'll just have to wait and see if anyone comes out and puts out a rebuttal to it. But multiple universes and the idea that there could be different laws of physics out there, that's something that we're going to inevitably discuss. And it borders, as you said, that realm of the divine, which is something I think that people who study this are willing to hear about. And I think for these people, that is the God that they see, at least some of them.
That could very well be.
So that pretty much wraps up this section on space. And as you can tell, we both love this subject here. And it provides so many opportunities for the future going forward. So our next one is computer science, which is something we've also discussed at length on the podcast before in various forms and incarnations. Meltdown and Spectre, the two biggest bugs that Intel had to deal with this year. I've talked about them on the podcast, but I'll let Sirion have a chance at explaining them.
Yeah, Meltdown and Spectre. I mean, if you haven't heard about this, then I don't know where I've been living. Basically, so CPUs are funny. CPUs are really good at executing instructions, but they need to do a few things in a row to execute those instructions. They need to like read the instruction. They need to prepare it. There's like a couple of steps. And what CPUs do is basically when they execute like a sequence of commands, when they execute one command, they already prepare the next one. And they sort of have like a pipeline going on. And this means they don't waste cycles and it can be as fast as possible. Now, what was found in the last year is that it is possible to write code in such a way where you can sort of use this smartness of the CPUs to find out what the value is of a certain variable, which means you can find information about things. And one of these, I think even made it possible to use this to trick the CPU in starting to execute some code that it is not supposed to execute, which means you can basically bypass a lot of code. And that's pretty severe because this speculative execution is a core principle in what makes computers fast these days. Like, without the technology, some of the programs you run might not even run on current technology because like they depend on that extra fastness. So finding this big vulnerability in there was a big deal, I think you could say.
Yeah. And you know, they were able to patch Meltdown via software patches, but Spectre is just one that they cannot patch because it deals with the actual CPU firmware. And we discussed this on the RSP and the Update podcast a couple weeks ago with Intel's new Sunny Cove architecture, that Sunny Cove is the first new chip from Intel to have Meltdown and Spectre patched at the hardware level. And to just give everybody an idea of how big this is, let's just say you were dealing with a password manager. The password manager could, in theory, with these bugs, if they weren't patched, be tricked into revealing sections of memory that have, believe it or not, unencrypted passwords in them. Because if the password manager was using speculative execution, and of course it would be, because it's a modern CPU, the branch that the chip would take when you entered your password correctly is, of course, executed. But the branch where you enter that password incorrectly is also taken. So if you enter it incorrectly, your passwords could still be there. So this was a big deal this year. I actually noticed a bit of a hit on my single-core performance after Apple patched Meltdown earlier this year in exporting audio and whatnot. And that's actually an easy place to notice a performance hit, is because Adobe Audition's audio exporting process is still single-core only. So you notice when it takes a little bit longer, even if it's just a bit. And it was noticeable after that patch. So when it comes down to it, though, these are bugs, and these are, I guess, would you call this a bug or a feature?
Meltdown and Spectre were definitely bugs, I would say.
Okay. Based on a feature, though.
Based, like, they were a bug in the speculative execution feature. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, this is just something that had been lying in these CPUs for years. Intel didn't know about it. It took some security researchers doing some very, very obscure things to be able to uncover that they actually existed. And then, you know, there was actually a very nice website put down on the internet for this called meltdownattack.com. And it goes through each of them and talks about what their various flaws are and how they can be worked around and ultimately how they were fixed. But this is something, when bringing it back to the central topic of computer science, hardware architectures that, and I think in general software engineering too, but not at this level, is that you can write some code, you can build the processor, it can run fine for years, and you might not necessarily know there's a bug in it.
Yeah, and I mean, we start trusting more and more processes to computers and automation, and you know, it's scary to think that one tiny fit bug could have massive impact. I mean, your bank account is basically numbers in a program right now. Like, imagine something going wrong there. Like, imagine all the money traffic, all the stock exchanges in the world be completely disrupted. The financial damage would be immeasurable. And all it would take is one line of code that is missing like a symbol or something like that. It's scary that these things can happen. And, you know, I think it's, I mean, of course, Meltdown and Spectre weren't good, but I think it's good that every now and then one of these things happens and that
we wake ourselves up.
That this got the media attention it deserves. Yeah. So that people are aware of the fragility of software engineering.
Yeah. And this wasn't just Intel, it was AMD as well, because AMD licensed the x86 architecture and standards from Intel, so that brought that over. But also ARM processors that run our smartphones, and this was a bit surprising at the beginning, because all of these ARM chips and whatnot were designed with what's called a reduced instruction set. So we were thinking, okay, these ARM chips that run our smartphones and whatnot are simpler. Are they going to be affected by Meltdown and Spectre? And they were, because this speculative execution technology that provides that speed boost was also implemented in ARM processors as well. So, you know, it's just something that happens, and it's something that, you know, you can't prepare for, but you need to know how to fix it once the problem is discovered. And I think we can say that in general for bug reporting, is that you can take steps to write proactive code and design things so that there's a chance of having fewer bugs, right? But you're never going to have the ability to write something that has zero bugs in it or zero hardware defects.
I mean, you can do something called defensive programming, where you attempt to watch, like, to program against every single vulnerability and bug. The problem is you'll never get anything done.
Yep.
And in the end, this is a free market. This is capitalism. People need to earn money with their product. So there is always a level of risk that you're going to have to accept if you want to make change. Like, if you want to change something, you have to break something first. Like, it sounds like a line of a villain from a superhero movie, but no, it is true.
It's true,
right?
Very true.
If you want to change something, you need to take the risk that comes with it. And, you know, if you work on, like, some critical hospital software, the trade-off is going to be very different than when you are making a video game, which is why video games generally have more bugs than hospital software, or so one would hope. But, you know, there's always the trade-off, and you can't rule out risk, because if you spend all your time on risk, making a feature will take infinitely much time.
And just cycling back to our discussion on Insight with this, we mentioned that, you know, there's an 11-minute delay, so everything regarding the landing of Insight was pre-programmed in, and all of this is, of course, software code.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been bugs in spaceships before, going to different planets and even just going up to low Earth orbit, that have caused catastrophic explosions on the pad. So, I mean, there you have it.
I mean, there was once a conversion error between Imperial and Metric system that caused a spaceship to crash. So,
yep.
You know, bugs happen.
That's right.
Also switch to the metric system. Like everyone else.
Yeah, everything science related should be metric. I wonder what they were trying to convert between Imperial and metric in that case.
I think it was the orbit height or something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next topic in computer science is machine learning and AI. And we wanted to do this one because there's a lot of questions about this in the media, and the media often gets it wrong when it comes to artificial intelligence. And people are, at this point, scared of artificial intelligence when they don't need to be. I don't remember exactly the way we wanted to explain this, so I'm going to let you do that, the difference between machine learning and AI.
Artificial intelligence, I don't really know how to explain it. Like, I don't know what the definition is, but I can give you the definition for machine learning. And I mean, definition is a big word, but machine learning is the concept where we hand a computer a set of input and a set of output. Like, basically we say this, like for image processing, for example, we give it an image and we say, this is a cat. And this is a dog, and this is not a cat. And like, we keep feeding it images, like millions of images, and we let the computer figure out how it can go from input to output. Now, there is a lot of math below this, and a lot of, I'm going to call it magic. It's not magic, but like, nobody in the end really knows what the computer is doing to categorize these images. However, after you had it learn how to do the images you know the output of, you can start giving it images that you don't know the output of, and it will start using the same model to predict what is there. Like, if you give a computer 1,000 images of a cat and 1,000 images of a dog, it will sort of take out the attributes, and then it will be able to start recognizing whether an image is a cat or a dog. But if you then give it a rabbit, it will have no idea what to do. That's machine learning, right?
Yeah.
That's
One of my favorite examples of this is, everybody can see this, as Google Photos. You know, if you go to a zoo, and this is a perfect example for it, you search for gorillas, all the gorillas should come up. Same thing with penguins. And this is, of course, how they do that. Because there's nothing in my photos that say, these two photos I have from this past July at the Calgary Zoo are penguins, but Google Photos knows that I have two photos of penguins.
Yeah.
It just does.
And now I think AI is something more general. I think what we consider under AI is that a computer could do smart tasks intelligently, but it isn't actually intelligent. Like, it's artificially intelligent.
that's where you get the terminology. It's not intelligent like a human. It's created to be that way. And I think the issue with AI comes in is because there are so many doomsday movies. The biggest one is, of course, Terminator, where you have the rogue AI comes online, sees humans as the enemy, and launches a war against them. So anytime people hear about the talk of AI developing and whatnot today, that's what they're going to think of. But I think we both agree on this, that we are decades and decades away from something like this being even remotely possible.
So what a lot of people think about when they say AI, they mean the general AI. Or AGI is artificial general intelligence. And what the definition of that is basically that is an artificial intelligence that can do any task that a human could do.
AKA that's a computer, or a computer that acts as a human.
Yes. Now, first of all, I don't think a computer can ever be as good as coming up with puns as me. Let's just make that clear.
Or you could say me, because I threw those two in at the beginning here entirely.
Or you. Whatever. Anyway, like, I agree. I think we're decades of AGI. But I think what we do need to think of is we are seeing more and more things being handed to AI, and it's quite kind of scary, right? And I think technologically we are doing pretty well. I think in terms of philosophy behind it and like what it means, like when is something sentient, for example, we don't have answers for that. And I think we're behind on that. And that is maybe the part that scares me a bit. Like when we actually develop this AI, maybe we are not really ready for it. Like we as a humanity, as a society, are not ready to deal with this technology.
Yeah. And I'll give you a prime example of this. I was reading, I forget what paper it was in, but a while back I was reading, you know, one of my other interests is economics. I was reading that there are some AIs in development that people are seeking to turn onto the stock market. And I personally don't like the idea of that. Because as we all know, we had something called the 2008 financial crisis, which was perpetrated by big banks and big businesses taking on more risk than they could. And if you're going to have eventually an AI controlling areas of the stock market, and that AI's goal would be presumably to maximize profits, we don't know what kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Catchphrases? No. Basically, I'm looking for a word that describes what kind of not continuities. What's the word I'm looking for? What's the word where exceptions? What kind of exceptions would be in place that would prevent this AI from just seeking to maximize profit at all else, even if it would be a harm to the economy? And then you could say that at that time you might have a situation where the stock market would automatically shut down. And if that was to start happening based on volume trades, then that is something that should be looked at. And this goes into your discussion about, are we ready to have this kind of level of AI? Another one, of course, that comes in is with drones and whatnot. Drones determining what is a good target and what is not a good target. So there's lots of discussions in general about limited cases of AI that need to be
had. I think what is worth reading, and I would like to plug something else here, is the robot series by Isaac Asimov.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
They're quite old books, but there's a set of short stories, and in one of them there's mega computers. I think they're called Multivac. That basically control like all the trade. They make sure that food is like spread across the world, and you know, a lot of control is related to them. And you know, everybody always quotes the rules of robotics, Asimov's rules of robotics, right? The three laws of robotics. But the interesting thing about these short stories is how Asimov is actually trying to show how these rules might not actually be completely solid. They might not be enough. And that, I think, is fascinating and recommended reading if you're interested in this topic. Because it goes beyond, like, all this stuff. Like, one of the rules is that robots cannot do harm to a human, but, like, what if you have to defend a human from doing harm to another human, but you have to, like, this goes to, like, the trolley problem, and I don't want to talk about the trolley problem, but, you know, this is complicated stuff, and we have so much to figure out. Like, we can't even make these decisions yet. How can we expect AI to make these decisions?
Yep. And, you know, as you said, that's probably something that's missing. And if there's going to be one development of AI in the next 5 years, that might be a good place to focus on, right? Because
yeah, I mean, technologically,
we're also going to have AIs driving cars.
Technologically, things are going to keep pushing ahead. And, you know, we're doing really well. We're behind on this topic. And, you know, we need to get going. We need to get cracking. And I think we saw some progress on that last year, and I'm hoping it's going to continue to do that, because we need to sort of come together and decide who we want to be as humanity when it comes to AI.
And when you compare that with everything else we're dealing with too, you can understand why this is pushed off to the side.
Yeah.
So, all right. Now, as we started with space, we started close and local and moving farther away. We're doing the same thing with computer science. Now we're going to talk about the far future and quantum computing. You know, I remember hearing about the first quantum computer that was theorized, and the idea behind quantum computing is that you utilize an atom or something along the scale of that, and it can have, as we said in the quantum universe when we were talking about the various theories in the eternal inflation story, is it can have multiple states at the same time. And what this does for computing, or at least is theorized to do for computing, is that you will be able to have a computer that is magnitudes and magnitudes more powerful than we have today, so much so that it's theorized that a working, and I underscore working there, quantum computer could make all encryption as we know it today obsolete, because it's just that powerful that it could break it.
I am going to enjoy this. I think you sort of fell in a trap there, and I think I need to debunk a bit of a myth. So a quantum computer is not necessarily more powerful than a normal computer. It is incomparable to a computer the way it works. For normal arithmetic, like normal sums, a quantum computer is not going to be necessarily better. And that is because, remember when we talked about the cat, we are not sure if it's dead or alive. Like, it's all probabilities, and quantum computers are a bit the same. Like, it is all a bit weird. So quantum computers are very specialized. They can do certain things really, really well. Now, one of the things it can do really well is solving a problem that is really hard to solve in a conventional way. And because it's really hard to solve in a conventional way, we base our cryptographic algorithms on the hardness of this problem. Like, basically, an algorithm is cryptographically secure if just trying random numbers is as easy as solving the problem using math. But quantum computers can do weird things that make it much, much faster than trying all values. And that is where the risk to cryptography comes from. But it's not necessarily that these computers are vastly more powerful in your day-to-day operations. Like, quantum computers would not be really good at running games, for example, because that is a lot of imperative arithmetic.
So then would it be fair to say that at a specific task for which the said quantum computer is designed, it could be magnitudes faster?
Yes. Okay. And we talk orders and orders of magnitude.
Right.
Like, we talk about solving a problem that would take a normal computer years in the matter of a day, maybe a few days.
And we're not really making, you know, there's people think that, you know, this is something that is going to be marketed and it's going to be marketed towards individuals and such. But the reality is that these are going to be designed on a case-by-case basis to do very specific things. And when it comes down to it at the end of the day, it's going to depend on the application and if that can be used for something else. And I'm not sure.
I mean, this is normal computers started this way, right?
Right.
Like, I remember that at some point, a Dutch politician was like, let's make a computer for all the Dutch people and put it on this square in The Hague and everybody can use it and that will be enough forever. One computer. And now we're all carrying at least one in our pocket, generally.
Yeah.
Like, it is foreseeable that quantum computing is going to become a mainstream thing. Our concept of programming might completely change as they come along. But,
you know, that's something I've actually been thinking about, too, is that how would you even write code for something like that? Because everything we do today depends on variables having a known value. If A equals 3, do something. If A is greater than 5, do something else.
I mean, there's a lot of interesting, cool videos on YouTube explaining like how quantum cryptographics would work. It's super interesting. It also explains how you can sort of get around the problem. Like, you can actually make algorithms that can't be breached by quantum computing. The downside is you need quantum computing for that, of course. So, you know, it's there are theoretically, this is already figured out. I think a lot of theory around quantum computing we have nailed down. The problem is making a physical piece of hardware that can do this. That is the current challenge.
Now, we didn't discuss this in pre-show like we discussed the AI in pre-show. Do you think we're decades away from that as we are with general AI?
I think quantum computing is closer than general AI. I mean, we know how fast computing can go, but, you know, we are reaching the limits of what we can do with the current hardware.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think it's Moore's law that, like, computing power doubles every year. We're not going to keep up.
No.
And, you know,
hence,
it's going to flatten off.
Hence Sunny Cove, 10 nanometer.
Yeah.
And at that point, Intel can either keep redesigning the architecture to be more efficient, or they can put more cores on the chip.
Yeah. So, like, the reason why we can't make this hardware smaller is because of quantum mechanics. If you make the hardware so small, the probability that things get messed up because one electron decides to be different, and yes, quantum mechanics can do that, that probability becomes so high that you can't count on the results of a computer anymore because everything is so small. And that is where the limit of miniaturization. This episode has so many difficult words. Miniaturization. Like, where we are at the limits, and that's why we need to have, like, this big step up to a completely new system. I think we are probably at least a decade away, but multiple decades, I don't think so.
Okay. And just FYI, there is a working quantum computer in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada, called Deep Wave, that has solved quantum chemistry problems.
Cool.
So, and here we have a specific application for it. So, obviously far away, and you know, you're going to hear about it in the media and whatnot. And you know, if they did design a quantum computer, and yes, I misspoke in regards to being everything faster, but if they design a quantum computer to break some specific thing or focus on some specific area, sure, that'll happen.
The NSA is going to be calling.
There you go. Did you hear that Drive Savers, the U.S. company, claims that they can access the data on any encrypted iPhone now?
Nope. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have a secret quantum computer.
Maybe. But, you know, once again, when it comes down to these things, Meltdown, Spectre, machine learning, AI, and quantum computing, we wanted to talk about these things because they're the future. At least in regards to AI and machine learning and quantum computing. But if you listen to the mainstream media on these, they're likely to get them wrong. So, All right.
Like Shane.
That's right. All right. On to our last segment here. You know, electric cars and supercapacitors and fusion. Now, I think it's no secret that electric cars are becoming more affordable year by year, right?
Definitely.
And, you know, there was the old idea that you used to have to go to a specific place to charge these cars because household voltage wouldn't be able to charge them. But now we're at a point where your car, if it's an electric car, can be charged off of a 120 volt outlet here in North America and 240 over there in Europe, where it can just be charged up and used as per usual. But there's actually a coming advancement in the next number of years that's going to make electric cars and whatnot lighter and make them able to go faster and use less energy, and that's supercapacitors. So supercapacitors are actually – well, actually, first, a capacitor in general is a piece of metal, generally dense metal, that holds a charge and is able to release that charge gradually. Now, a supercapacitor, on the other hand, is able to take in a great deal amount of energy quickly, store it, and then release it over time. And the idea behind supercapacitors is that you can have, in theory, batteries that you can recharge and literally just plug into the wall in minutes, and then you'll be good for days on use. But what we can also get from supercapacitors is an improvement in battery technology of electric cars to the point where the batteries in electric cars are small and manageable and don't take up a huge chunk of the real estate in an electric car. If you've seen any of the electric cars that came around in the last decade or so, they were all batteries in the trunk or under the hood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what supercapacitors will allow us to do is to improve this battery technology so they'll be able to go further, faster, and charge faster. Now,
I mean, the we just talked about miniaturization of the computing power,
right?
But like, batteries have the exact same problem, right? The biggest problem with batteries and electric cars, and for example, thinking about, say, electric planes in the future, is the charge per like volume and per mass that you can store is really, really bad. Like we are not far enough in developing this technology to make really compact batteries. And on top of that, we are also not really good at making these fast. And I mean, Tesla is doing a great job, but they have multiple massive factories dedicated to building the batteries for the cars to actually make a significant number of cars per week. Like, batteries are the main bottleneck in the adoption of electric transport vehicles, I would say.
I'm going to completely agree with you there. And that's why supercapacitors are so interesting. You know, they can hold this one technology that I've highlighted in the show notes is that it can hold over 10 times as much energy per unit volume as a traditional capacitor. And what the real interesting part about this capacitor technology highlighted in the notes is that it's as thin as a piece of paper.
Nice.
So, I mean, you imagine how you can utilize this and build larger capacitors and stack them on each other. You are going to end up having some batteries that are going to have a lot of power with them, and that fixes part of the electric car problem. And, you know, for the longest time, I was against electric cars because, you know, you have to produce the batteries. You have to, you know, if you dispose of the car, you need to make sure the battery is disposed of properly. And there was a horrible story. Someone was driving their electric car. They hit a telephone pole. The car caught on fire because of the battery. And you know, people need to realize is that these batteries that we're using today are dangerous. I think we can all agree that lithium-ion batteries are dangerous, right?
I don't think we can all agree. I think it is scientifically a bit sketchy. Like, it's not.
Well, I mean, they're not dangerous, but if they malfunction or if they get punctured, then they can become dangerous.
Yeah, but so can a fuel tank. So
yeah, but we've seen many stories before. Even in the Boeing 787, that had a battery compartment that was lithium ion, poorly manufactured. And this goes back to the original point that batteries in themselves are, as you said, the bottleneck for changing the way electric vehicles and everything electric works. And that's why supercapacitors are an important technology to watch, not in the next decade, but I'd say probably the next 5 years or so. So, I hope everybody can take a read through this, because this is definitely something that can help us on the push for more battery-based power. Now, the next piece of news regarding this is that, you know, we've often heard about nuclear power, right? Nuclear fission, splitting atoms to generate power. And, you know, we've talked about horrible things happening in Chernobyl, where that's perhaps the most famous nuclear meltdown that happened. There was the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island, also the Fukushima meltdown after the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Now, nuclear fission is, of course, in that way perceived as dangerous. You know, splitting atoms to generate power is something that is harvested and slowed down in time. The reaction is slowed down because, of course, that's the same process as nuclear bombs. Now, on the other hand, you have something called nuclear fusion, which is what people have been dreaming about for decades. And the idea behind this is that rather than splitting atoms apart, you can merge atoms together, fuse them to create heavier atoms. And what you end up with as a process of that is heat. And there's one really good fusion reactor, and all you need to do to see it is look up at the sky. Don't look up at the sun with your eyes, but just know that the sun is up there, and that's perhaps the best and most stable fusion reactor in our lifetimes that we'll see. And people have been always trying to duplicate fusion on the ground, and people in the United States at MIT, I believe it was, yes, it was MIT, they have something called the Spark Reactor, and it's down now to an engineering problem rather than a science problem, in that they believe that within 5 to 10 years, by 2025, they will be able to have this reactor that will produce a power output between 50 and 100 megawatts, which is enough power to run a small city. And the upshot of this is that this fusion reactor would be entirely clean burning. There would be no nuclear residue as we have with fission. There would be no emissions as you have with a coal-fired power plant. At the end of the day, all you would likely have is the creation of extra helium atoms if they are indeed fusing hydrogen here. And this is something that the world, and perhaps it'll come to the developed world first, because this is going to be an expensive technology to create, is that this could revolutionize the energy industry in the developed world and the developing world once it slims down and becomes more cheap.
To bring it back, like, especially because more and more we are starting to move away from combustion engines and like cars, like the way we, like if we all switch to electric cars, but all the electricity comes from coal plants, like, there's no net difference at that point. It's probably a net loss because of all the extra production costs of the batteries.
Right.
And
that's my view. That was
a lot of people try to need more wind power, need more solar power. But if you look at it, like, those are actually quite inefficient ways of getting energy. Like, all the efforts we put into it, and I think it is like 1 or 2% of the energy in the world comes from these sources right now, after all the effort we put in.
Yeah.
And everybody always talks about how dangerous nuclear fission is, but nuclear fission, sure, we have the chemical residue, but we have ways to store them. It's not entirely clean, maybe, but definitely better than completely polluting our planet. You know, and people always talk about how unsafe it is, but it is not, really. Like, If you look at Fukushima, which is considered the biggest meltdown in the modern, like recently in any fission plant, there has been one death, and it's not even a confirmed death, caused by the radiation of that meltdown. One. There are more people being killed from other energy sources. I don't have the details on this. I just remembered seeing the numbers that, like, more people get hit by blades of a wind turbine.
Birds.
Like wind turbines cause more deaths than fission plants. And yet we want more wind turbines. Right?
Yeah, and
the safety argument is complete bollocks. So it is, I think, a propaganda issue. Fission power is probably the cleanest, most efficient, and safest way of efficiently generating energy that we currently have to our disposal. But irrational reason, we don't want to build more of it. Right. Even though it would be really easy to make a significant portion of our energy be powered by these plants.
Yeah, just ask the U.S. Navy. I mean, their aircraft carriers are powered by it. Their submarines are powered by it. And these are reactors that are contained inside moving objects at sea, which when you think about it, you're far more likely to have a collision on the sea with a submarine or an aircraft carrier than you are to have a nuclear power plant penetrated in Alberta, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the arguments here are really strange. There's probably more going on that maybe we aren't even aware of. But I guess let's just hope that nuclear fusion doesn't get this image of unsafe and badness attached to it. And maybe we just skip fission and go straight to fusion. But you're right. If this might be an expensive technology for now, which would harm adoption, even though we know we have to start adopting these things sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And, you know, I can say this. I live in Alberta, which is home to the second or third largest oil reserve in all of the world. And we are currently using the oil reserves as a way to make ourselves rich. But there's going to be, at some point in the future, a declining demand for oil and fossil fuels, and that is going to be caused by one of these renewable energy sources, whether it be fission or a rebirth of fission or new fusion plants coming on, or something else that we haven't even thought of yet, that is going to move that area away. And I think of all of these things that we have talked about here, fusion is perhaps the most interesting one going forward. Because it doesn't have the, as we said, the stigma that fission currently has. And if we could figure out a way to do this, it would solve most of the energy issues that we have. And I think it's also safe to say that most of the modern wars have also been fought over energy as well. So it would be a good thing to do for all of humankind, I think, something when it comes to fusion power. Now, I'm trying to get a list of all of the countries that are still using fission, but that list is providing hard to find at the moment currently. So I know the U.S.
France
does it.
And Germany have them.
Okay.
I think Belgium has a few. The Netherlands has one. There's a few countries that have them. I think either Germany or France, I forgot which of the two, after Fukushima, I wanted to shut all of them down, which is the opposite of what they need to do. But,
But as you can see here, wrapping this energy section up, fusion, advents in battery technology, supercapacitors, all have the ability to change the way our world currently works. And, you know, that's less so we're seeing it with machine learning, I think we could say right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
AI, sure, but general AI and quantum computing is still a far way away. And I think this is a good time to start wrapping up. And everything that we have talked about here is something that we, in some way or another, have been deeply passionate about. And this is a question that you asked, and I think we can answer this, is where would we like to be scientifically in 50 years? And where do we think we'll be?
I mean, I'm going to talk a bit meta here, but I definitely hope that in 50 years, people will believe in science a bit more. I could rant for another hour on flat earthers and people like that. And, you know, I think it's actively harmful that people are spending mental capacity on that bullshit.
You know, I think that's why Google made the maps, Google Maps, when you scroll out, have a globe.
Yeah, and I mean, people need to just trust in it, and, you know, we need to all use it. There's just people always so skeptical of science because it could potentially mean that they need to do something about, like, climate change or whatever, and we need to move away from that. Like, science is a good thing. It's a tool for us. Should not work against it. We should use it for good. So I hope that in 50 years, the attitude towards science has changed to be more embracing. Specifically, I do hope that we are at a point where at least space travel is more commonplace, where we have a permanent presence on somewhere in space, a civilian presence somewhere in space. That would be nice.
You could probably have it done on the moon.
The moon, maybe like another space station like the ISS, Mars. I don't really care. Let's just say a civilian presence permanent in space. That would be nice. Off Earth, at least. I hope there's a probe on the way to a different solar system. I hope we finally find the proof of Fermat's little theorem, because everybody wants to know. I don't know. I think I'm just hoping that we have in 50 years decided that if we just all come together as humanity and focus on science, I think the academic scene is much more international and globalized than many other fields. And I really hope that continues to grow, the international collaboration. More perspectives, more cultures is always a good thing. And I hope it has spread out to different initiatives, more global cooperation to make these things a reality. And I think that would be great. I think it is doable, but it will require all of us to do a little bit towards it.
All right. And, you know, on that note, our paper regarding the supercapacitors comes from Iran. The space information regarding InSight and Umana is from NASA. And, of course, Stephen Hawking, UK. So pretty much global in regards to most of the sources used on the podcast this week. Scientifically, in 50 years, as for me. You know, I think you summed that up quite well, but I would like to add on that I would like us to be able to be in a position where we're back to having regular space flight, because over the last decade or so, it seems as though that space flight has waned, though it does seem to be picking up again with the private angle. I would also, as you can tell, based on what I spoke regarding the energy section, I would like us to, you know, at some point have the fusion reactors developed to the point where they're not, where we can have a form of nuclear power that is widespread accepted and people aren't necessarily going to be scared of it. So that's that. And I think you covered it very well on space. And when it comes to computer science and machine learning and AI, you know, we didn't know what today was going to look like 10 years ago. So I don't think it's worth making a prediction for what 50 years down the road is going to look like in regards to that. I mean, who knew that we'd be going back to small screens on the smartphone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but why is science fun? I mean, we answered that. I think you could probably hear it in our voices, the joy that came from discussing all of these topics, because what they offer is they offer a glimpse of what we can ultimately be going forward. It is something that is achievable because it's also measurable in most of these cases through scientific experimentation and instrumentation, but also at the same time, it's something that is horribly funded. So I guess that could be something we could see in 50 years, see more funding towards sciences and whatnot.
I think – yeah, go on.
Okay, go ahead. I was just going to wrap up why science is fun so you can
– I think why science is fun, I think science is a celebration of human ingenuity.
And achievement.
Everything that is beautiful in the universe around us as well. It combines these two things, right? It shows the capacity we have to decipher the laws of physics around us, the mathematics behind it. We haven't talked about it, but things like genetics, biology, linguistics, all these things we have been able to untangle. We have made conclusions. Like, to me, this is all a celebration of all the good we could be. And like you talked about, like thinking about how we could use this for good and where we could be in 50 years. Like, right now we live in a turbulent time. Like, politically, things are really unstable. There's lots of things happening in the world. And it's easy to get sucked up in that and see the negativity. But every single time that I look at some new scientific discovery, it fills me with joy because, to me, it shows that, you know, there are still good things. We're still making progress. And it fills me with hope that one day we're all together in this journey to find out how things work around us and how we can make it better for everyone. And, you know, searching for the origin of these rules to me is a fun quest on its own. I love learning new things. I think the ability for us to learn new things is something we should embrace and use. And I just love learning new things because I can't really explain it. I think just I feel happy by learning more about how things work around me and being able to understand them is a positive force in life in general. And that is why I think science matters. And that is why I think that everybody should look into science and maybe not the topics we talked about, but maybe there's a different topic you're interested in and just reading up on it, watching YouTube videos on it, learning it. That in itself can be really rewarding. And those skills you will be able to use in life. You will be able to understand things. You'll be able to reason about things in a logical manner. And that will help in so many different ways that none of the time you spend on this will be wasted.
I completely agree. And, you know, just to expand onto that, you know, I think science is something that everybody can do because at its core, science is testing something, deciding if it's right, observing the results of what you did and figuring out how to change it next time to do something different. And it's something
science
that there is no barrier to get into.
Science is learning from mistakes. Sorry.
I'm done.
Yeah, like science is learning from observations and mistakes.
And there's no simpler way. There's no simpler way of putting it. And everything we talked about, from the exoplanets to the theories regarding eternal inflation, definitely that one. Meltdown and Spectre too. Machine learning, AI, quantum computing, and nuclear fusion. All of these things wouldn't have been possible if people didn't take a risk and try something that might not have worked. Refine the methods and tactics going forward to a point where they can write papers about it. And in some cases, and in the future with supercapacitors and nuclear reactors, market that as a solution to better mankind. and that's all there is to it. So.
So let me go super cheesy here, right? This is the first episode of 2019. So I want to challenge all the listeners this year, think of a topic and learn something about it.
That's a good one.
All I challenge you to, like, pick something you find interesting. Even if you read a single article about it, you have just increased your knowledge about it and your ability to reason about it in the future. That's all I'm asking. That's the challenge I give you for this entire year.
And that's the challenge that awaits in 2019. And I think that's a good place to leave this episode. We'll have full links in the show notes at update.rsbnb.com to all the articles that we talked about. I think we should even, you know, just for the hell of it, throw in a link to PBS Space Time, because that's gonna cover our space section quite well.
Yes, I totally agree.
All right. So links and lots of good stuff will be found in the show notes at update.rsbnb.com. We'll be back next week to discuss the first RuneScape update of 2019. So with that being said, see you next week, everyone.
See ya.